The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
What I have said is that United States, one of the reasons we had so much stability with democracy is we never had a market-dominant minority. Right? Again, a market-dominant minority is a little outsider minority that dominated the economy while being politically weak. We didn't have that. It was just whites controlled everything. Now what's happened is I think we are starting to see the emergence of our own very peculiar form of a market-dominant minority. And for lack of a better term, I'm identifying these coastal elites. In developing countries, you see over and over the rhetoric when you have a market-dominant minority is you always really, systematically, almost with very few exceptions, you will find a populist demagogue or many coming in saying, it's time to take back our country.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, March 24th, 2018. Tribalism has become a touchstone for many political scientists and commentators seeking to explain the rise of Donald Trump. Yale Law School professor Amy Chua argues in her new book, Political Tribes, Grouped Instinct, and the Fate of Nations, that both foreign and domestic policymaking must better handle the realities of political tribalism in order to find success. Last week, Harvard Law School professor, Hoover Senior Fellow, and Lawfare co-founder Jack Goldsmith spoke to Chua at the Hoover Book Soiree about her new volume. They discussed where past foreign policymakers overlooked the importance of tribalism, the nature of domestic tribalism in the modern United States, and much more. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 294, Amy Chua on Political Tribes.
This book transcends national security and foreign relations and domestic relations, and it uses a common idea to give really profound insight into both. So Amy, thank you for coming, and why don't you just tell us what the book's about?
Well, thanks for having me, and thank you all for coming. So I actually started writing this book 3 years ago as a pure foreign policy book. It was drawing on an older book I'd written in 2003 called World on Fire. And so very simply, the idea was that we in our foreign policy in the United States tend to see things in terms of grand ideological battles, whether it's communism versus capitalism, and then it was, you know, authoritarianism versus democracy, and most recently, freedom versus, terrorism or axis of evil. And because of these ideological blinders, we are spectacularly blind to, or actually ignorant about, the group identities that matter most to people on the ground in the countries where we go in and are trying to help. And these identities are often not national, but they could be ethnic, sectarian, religious, clan-based, regional, tribal, whatever. And this is in stark contrast to the British for reasons, fascinating reasons that I explore, who were just obviously for divisive purposes, but they were extremely group conscious. I found these old, I have research assistants here, these old British documents, about India. Just they knew everything about the caste, the rituals, the timing, and they used that, of course, to pit groups against each other. So anyway, I say that America's blindness to these the power of these group identities explains some of our greatest foreign policy disasters over the last 50 years, from Vietnam to Afghanistan to Iraq to Venezuela. Why this is now a different, the book it is that last February, I was about 5 months away from having to turn in the whole manuscript. I was teaching a class called International Business Transactions, which I've taught for 20 years, and I was making a point I've made for 20 years, which is that because the developing world has such different political and social dynamics than the United States, we keep messing it up. We just don't understand these other countries. So I'm reading from a passage from my own book, and it says, under certain conditions, populist leaders with no political experience can sweep to power on an anti-establishment platform, horrifying the elites, tapping into deep social resentments, you know, in a racially tinged way. And I stopped, and I was actually reading about Hugo Chavez. That was at the passage about Venezuela. And I stopped, and 80 people in my class looked up. They were all thinking the same thing. And one woman said something, and she said, "It sounds exactly like you're describing the United States." A light bulb went off. I actually saw things in a different way. And I do think that this lens of not, we're so fixated on how did we get to this weird spot here. Once you start seeing it as part of a larger global pattern, there are a lot of insights, and not just as a global pattern with Europe. I know a lot of people say, oh, we're like the far right movements. I think, for reasons I'll explain, that we are now starting to display in this country many of the destructive political dynamics more typically associated with what we would call the developing world or non-Western countries. So that's kind of what the book is about.
That's great. So we'll start with the foreign policy. Before we get to some of the examples, and I think just choosing a couple of them because they're all basically the same, but could you just review the extraordinary work you reviewed in the book about how we're hardwired to be tribalistic and how it's just a natural tendency?
Yes. So human beings, like our fellow primates, are tribal. We are desperate to belong to groups, and we will force a group, make a group, almost instinctively. One of the many studies, they took a bunch of kids between the ages of 4 and 8, and they divided them in half, red group, blue group, and they gave them corresponding t-shirts, so red t-shirts and blue t-shirts. They then sat these children in front of these computer docs and showed all the children computer-edited images of random children, half of whom were wearing red t-shirts and half of whom were wearing blue t-shirts. And then they asked the subjects for their reactions to the kids in the images. The responses were astounding. Even though these children didn't know anything about the children in the computer images, they consistently said that they liked the children better wearing the color that they were wearing. They allocated more resources to the children wearing those colors. And they thought that those children wearing their color were basically morally superior in every way. And most scary, they displayed strong unconscious bias. They recounted, they told stories about these boys and girls. And then when asked to talk about them, the children consistently remembered all of the good things about the children wearing their color and all of the negative things about the children wearing the other color. So the point is that it's just, we can overcome it, but our natural tendency, our default, is to be very tribal. And once we connect to a group, we tend to cling to it. We will defend it no matter what. It's not always bad. We'll come back to that. But I do think it's dangerous when tribalism takes over a political system, because when we connect with a group, we start to see everything through the lens of that group. And what can happen is that facts and arguments start to not matter. And just one final study, my colleague Dan Kahan and others too have found that, so you could take a group of people and show them the exact same numbers, the exact same data, studies, let's say about gun control. And looking at the same data, half of those people will conclude that's why we need fewer guns, and the other half, based on the exact same numbers and analysis, studies, will conclude that's why we need more guns. And here's the kicker. He found that people who are better at numbers, who are smarter, with more numeracy skills, are better at manipulating the facts to fit their side's view. So that's very disturbing, because it means that unless you get out of your tribal mindset, that's why we get so little progress done, because it's not determinative. People will just interpret facts to fit their side's perspective.
So that basic insight is kind of at the foundation of both the foreign policy part of the book and the domestic policy part of the book. So let me summarize what I take to be the main foreign policy claim, and that is that the United States in the last 50 years, I think you start with the Vietnam example, has intervened in part to try to bring democracy to nations that were striven with ethnic conflict or group conflict, and that we didn't appreciate the intensity of the group conflict, and we didn't appreciate that bringing democracy and loosening what were at the time authoritarian regimes would in fact open up these extraordinarily vicious tribal conflicts. And that we were blinded by that over and over again and believed that we could bring democracy to these worlds, partly because we at least thought we were able to have an assimilative culture at home, and therefore we were blind to how destructive this was going to be abroad. Is that a fair summary?
Very fair. I mean, I would say that we have, in the United States, again, for very idiosyncratic reasons, different from a lot of European countries, we, I think, tend to view democracy as a panacea, that maybe there's some group conflict and tribal stuff, but democracy and markets will actually melt those away. So we think of elections as the cure. You know, there are all these regression studies. We're going to have inter-ethnic parties form. Going back to the reason, I think that a lot of it is our own history. This country was dominated for almost 200 years, economically, politically, culturally, by a white majority. And that just being economic and political power all concentrated in one group's hands can produce lots of invidious results, slavery, obviously, but it's also politically very stable. And it hides the fact that markets and democracy sometimes can be in tension. If one, you know, markets can sometimes benefit one ethnic group and democracy can benefit another. But in the United States, democracy is actually, there's a reason we romanticized it.
So the failure, but as you point out, time and time again, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Vietnam, we keep making the same mistake over and over again, thinking that democracy can resolve or paper over these conflicts. And time again, I think, as you say, it kind of unleashed these forces.
Yeah, so one of the reasons I wrote this book is in 2003, in the afterword to my book, World on Fire, I predicted Iraq exactly right. And not just like, oh, it's probably not going to be good, but precisely. And that's because I coined this term, market-dominant minorities, in 2002. And again, this is kind of a taboo thing. I got in a lot of trouble when that came out, too. But a market-dominant minority is a small ethnic minority, often viewed as an outsider, that controls vast amount of a country's economic wealth. So, for example, the 3% Chinese minority in Indonesia controls about 70 to 80% of Indonesia's private economy, including almost all the largest conglomerates. And I think it's very uncomfortable for Americans to deal with this concept. At first, it's like, you must be stereotyping. And I just present all the numbers. I think in America, United States, we're much more comfortable with minorities that are both economically and politically oppressed, because we know how to deal with that morally. You know, Tibetans, Uyghurs, we need to not have oppression. What do you do with a rich minority? So I coined this term, and I saw that in Iraq, on the eve of our intervention, and a lot of our friends got it wrong. I mean, we have a lot of friends who said, no, we're going to have parties are going to, the process will bring groups together, they'll have to form these alliances. And I said, look at the numbers. We have a 15% Sunni minority, a market-dominant minority, that has been dominant for actually hundreds of years. First under the Ottomans, which were a Sunni power, then under the British, who loved to do divide and rule and ruled through that minority, and finally under Saddam Hussein. So to me, it was a no-brainer that when we bring democracy, majority rule, who are we empowering? The long-oppressed 60% Shia who have been upset and persecuted and furious, they're going to weaponize their vote for payback. And that's exactly what happened. The groups voted along sectarian lines. Shias voted for Shias, Sunnis voted for Sunnis, Kurds voted for Kurds. And then Sunnis, once they realized this is not going to go our way, the Shias are going to use their power to exact revenge, they joined the insurgency. The Sunnis decided to block democracy, joined up with al-Qaeda, and ISIS, again, we think of it as a fundamentalist movement, is a Sunni movement.
Yeah.
So that's an example of democracy actually catalyzing group conflict as opposed to smoothing it away.
And you give a lot of examples of that happening in the book. It's a wonderful prescription. It explains a lot of different events. I'm not quite sure of the mechanism. You argue in the book that we're kind of naive or blind to how democracy is going to work in these countries that have these emerged tribal conflicts, in part because we think democracy has worked well at home. But you also said something in your answer just now. You said it's difficult to deal with these concepts of cultural and group identity. And I wonder if part of the problem is that we've been so trained in this country to suppress those ideas, maybe even it's politically correct to suppress them, that it's just not a legitimate factor to take into account, even in foreign policy. Could that be partly an explanation?
Partly. I mean, so I actually say that our group blindness compared to the British, it's really very stark when they were on the world stage. I say that I think it's rooted in both the best of America and the worst of America. Part of the best, I mean, this is a little bit of a different slant. We really have had exceptional success assimilating incredibly diverse peoples. Yes, mostly from, Europe, but the idea, I think, is, look, if Italians and Germans and Poles and Hungarians and Jews could all become Americans within one generation, Sunnis, Shias, Kurds, why can't they all become Iraqis? Let's just have some elections. The second reason I think that we're blind is the darkest part of America, and I actually now hate this word because I think it's overused, but I think it's racism. So a Vietnam chapter, one of my big points is United States Americans didn't really think there was much difference between the Vietnamese and the Chinese. They're all Asians, Japanese, Korean, just Asians. And it was just a fatal error. Because even though they're all Asians, the Vietnamese view the Chinese as this mortal enemy. We think that we're central in Vietnam history. For the Vietnamese, China, which sits like a huge behemoth over tiny Vietnam, is almost like the defining force. We also miss the fact that Vietnam had a market dominant minority. So most of the capitalists in Vietnam, this is actually a new angle that I'm excited about. Most of the capitalists in Vietnam were not even members of the Vietnamese people. They were members of this Chinese minority. So here we come in, we're like, we're going to put in capitalism and all of our wartime policies benefited this little Chinese group because they were the middlemen. You know, our troops needed provisioning, supplies. They also controlled the black market, brothels. So we were shooting ourselves in the foot. We come in unaware that everything we're doing actually looks like we thought we were saving the world, from the domino theory, communism. What we were actually, how we were perceived is that we're putting in policies just helping this resented outsider minority that always had been so dominant there. And those Chinese minority didn't even, they acted like foreigners. They dodged the draft. They didn't even fight on the Vietnamese side. So they were really viewed as a very resented force. One more fun fact that I just think is so interesting. I'm of the age where I remember the Vietnamese boat people. In the late 70s, we refer to them, refugees. It turns out that in 1978, for example, 80% of those Vietnamese boat people were actually ethnic Chinese. And I'll sometimes ask students, because there was ethnic cleansing and they were sent out, and I'll talk to Vietnamese students and they'll say, no, I'm just Vietnamese. No. I'll say, go ask your parents or grandparents. They'll come back, oh my gosh, because they couldn't admit that they were Chinese because that would be very dangerous. So they was, but I thought that was interesting too.
So let me ask you one more foreign policy question. And I want to push you on some of the implications of your critique because it's a pretty dramatic, sweeping critique. The dominant American foreign policy commitment, at least since the end of the Cold War, and strands of it going back long before then, and that is trying to spread democracy to the world. And you're basically saying that that is the road to disaster in a lot of contexts. So my question is that fair, and what is the foreign policy prescription? Because it might require a large rethinking of some of our foreign policy commitments, and it also sounds I don't know if you like this label, very realist. Is that fair?
So I think, you know, this is crazy, but I'm a huge optimist on all fronts. I think if you read the book, you will find, I've had this reaction, that we made so many obvious mistakes. So many obvious mistakes. So to answer your question, what is democracy, right? What is it? And I've been saying, what I argue in the book is that we're not even exporting what we have. We'll get to what we have later.
That's the next question.
Yeah, but I mean, it's you know, so if you're saying, should we do overnight elections with majority rule, yeah, I think that that is a not a smart prescription. Overnight, as you know, in our country, we had a we don't like to admit it, but we had very gradual process before we moved to universal suffrage. You know, first we had property qualifications, we didn't let the poor vote. Obviously, minorities, women couldn't vote, and so it was a gradual process. And by the time we arrived at something like universal suffrage, we had the New Deal in. We had redistributive mechanisms. So I think that we have not even learned from our own history. And by the way, the United States is uniquely naive. I used to go to these conferences down in Latin America. It would always be about democracy and rule of law. But Jack, I could tell, and I didn't think my colleagues could, that the Latin American elites, all very progressive, were talking about something else when they called for democracy. That's why it's an answer. Their sense of democracy often has a lot of minority protections in it, a lot more education, you know. People from developing countries have long been afraid of poor majorities. And we're almost like in the, you know, minority not to worry about that.
But is it fair to say that your prescription would be very dangerous to intervene in Libya, very dangerous to intervene the way we did in Iraq. Afghanistan, the idea that we could transform that society was foolish. We went around about trying to bring sort of defeat communism in Vietnam in a way that was foolish. It sounds like it entails a much less interventionist foreign policy. Is that right?
I would do it case by case. I worked very closely. I used to have a little chapter on Libya, but it was too complicated. But I worked with a student, a Libyan-American student, and his take, and so that's why I resist a one answer for all thing. He actually thinks it was right to intervene in Libya for all reasons I can explain. But he actually just agrees with President Obama, who said that he said first our analysts failed to understand the importance of tribal division in that country, which is exactly what I'm saying. And secondly, he said that he thought that failing to plan for the day after in Libya was the greatest mistake of his presidency. So to answer your question, I think we almost did the worst of all worlds, right? Either not intervene or intervene with some sense. But I understand where President Obama was coming from. He was gun shy from Iraq. He didn't want to be in there, right? But there is a glimmer of hope. It didn't immediately disintegrate Libya. It was a gradual process. There were some elections. I mean, things started to happen. It could have gone differently. I think it could have gone differently. So I wouldn't say blanket no intervention, no.
Okay. So let's move on to really the extraordinary thing about this book is this same idea explains a lot about foreign policy and explains a lot about domestic politics. So let's talk about domestic politics. I'm a little confused in the book about this idea of a supergroup, and I'll describe it and you can tell me where I get it wrong. I think you say that the United States is the only contemporary or the main contemporary supergroup, and that a supergroup is a group or a nation that can assimilate other tribal groups or other groups and forge some kind of a common identity while at the same time allowing those identities to flourish. Is that...
I would put it even simpler because it's really the second half that is important. So I just think a supergroup group like Rome was a supergroup. You know, is you have two requirements. Very simple. One, a very strong overarching collective identity. You know, Roman or American. And secondly, it must be a group that accepts individuals of all backgrounds, but allows those subgroup identities to flourish. So I'm flinching when you say assimilation. I'm not a Mark Lila immediately liberalism. Everybody, you know, I think that this is a unique country. So I have a line like it would be weird to say Irish French. Right? That what kind of concept? But you can be Irish-American. So you could be Croatian-American, Korean-American, Libyan-American, and intensely patriotic at the same time. And I think that's actually, I know it sounds very simplistic, Jack, but I think it's such a a unique and special thing about us. And I think a lot of
Okay, so there's this idea that of this American identity, even while groups, qua groups flourish. And there's also this idea that we're losing that. Mm-hmm. And so could you explain that arc? And it has to do with the history of racism and the rise of identity politics.
Yes. So America,
and the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah, so America, just to repeat the obvious, was a country that was overwhelmingly dominated politically, economically, culturally by a white majority for most of our history. Obviously, white was always a moving target. Some groups that are considered white today were not then. But that's the basic dynamic. And so democracy was very, felt very stable. And it felt like we weren't tribal. It felt like we didn't have all this chaos. And that's because there was one big super tribe sort of imposing its identity on everything else. And there were plenty of subgroups that were just silenced or killed or, you know, so they were there. So, but when a group is so overwhelmingly dominant, it can do terrible things, slavery, oppress, but it can also be more generous. And what's happened now is two things in America. First, because of the massive demographic shifts, that is huge immigration flows in the last 30 years in terms of sheer numbers, but also in terms of where they're coming from, not just from Europe, but principally now from Asia, Latin America, Africa, whites are now on the verge of losing their majority status in this country. Predictions usually put it around 2044 that whites will no longer be a majority. The result of that is that every group in America now feels threatened. It's not just the minorities who have always felt threatened, but whites now feel threatened. And some of these studies, statistics, I had to go back and check them. I just couldn't believe them. 67% of working class whites feel that they are more discriminated against and persecuted than minorities. 67% of working class whites, and fully and more than half of all whites feel that way. Asians and Latinos feel threatened. It's not just Jews and Muslims who feel threatened now. Christians feel threatened. You can really see that in the political rhetoric right now. With Donald Trump in the office, women feel threatened. But with the Me Too movement, men feel threatened.
But who are they threatened by? Are these the other groups? Is that the
yes,
idea?
Yes, they feel very targeted by, I mean, in fact, it's in the vocabulary. Conservatives and liberals both feel threatened. I mean, they all, so when groups feel threatened, that's when they get more insular and more tribal, and that's when you things start to feel zero sum. And quickly, the other thing that happens that I think gets missed when people just hurl around, you know, white supremacy, the second big thing that happened, partly because of the decline in geographical mobility, is that class and really education has divided America's white majority. The divide between the people in this room, you know, coastal, urban, not necessarily wealthy, but educated, multicultural, cosmopolitan, we've traveled. The divide between whites in this category and whites in the heartland is so stark now that I actually say it's almost like an ethnic difference. You know, I've spent 20 years, I have one article where I have a 20-page footnote defining ethnicity, you know, all the different theories. But some of the markers are here. There was so little intermarriage. It is more likely that a Caucasian person from the coast will marry an Asian or a South Asian or somebody from Nigeria than somebody from, you know, Appalachia, actually, because there's a different vocabulary, different politics.
So how does the decline of white dominance relate to the rise of identity politics, and what is the dynamic that it's creating?
So America's always unique. What I have said is that United States, one of the reasons we had so much stability with democracy is we never had a market-dominant minority, right? Again, a market-dominant minority is a little outsider minority that dominated the economy while being politically weak. We didn't have that. It was just whites controlled everything. Now what's happened is I think we are starting to see the emergence of our own very peculiar form of a market-dominant minority. And for lack of a better term, I'm identifying these coastal elites, us. And it's, so first of all, I have lots of caveats in the book. Obviously, coastal elites are not an ethnic minority. They're not a religious minority. But having said that, it is, the parallels are astounding. Wealth in this country is enormously concentrated in our coasts. Silicon Valley, Wall Street, the Washington establishment, Hollywood, media. Although coastal elites are not an ethnic group, they are extremely insular and culturally distinct. We dress very similarly. We even have our own language. We're going to come back to this. I'm so well trained how to speak in a way that it doesn't offend different groups. We are superior. We view ourselves as cosmopolitan, tolerant, not like these other parts of the country, and we're extremely judgmental. So here's the interesting thing. In countries that have a market-dominant minority, a very powerful, resented minority that is viewed as an outsider, here's the thing about coastal elites. Because the heartland, or demagogues, from the point of view of rural America, working-class America, coastal elites are always trying to help minorities. They love minorities. They love immigrants. They want to let all the immigrants in. They love foreigners. They always want to help the African poor. They don't care about our own poor. You know, they want to. And so this language that in developing countries you see over and over, the rhetoric when you have a market-dominant minority is you always, really, systematically, almost with very few exceptions, you will find a populist demagogue, or many, coming in saying, it's time to take back our country. The reason you're so miserable is these outsiders are stealing the nation's wealth, they're giving it away to foreigners, and it is time to it's time to take back the country for the real owners. And you can really see in Make America Great Again, you know, over, it's not as explicit, but it's definitely a lot of people feel that that's what he was referring to. And he actually did use the, President Trump did use the term, let's take our country back from Mexico and from China. So it's a very parallel dynamic with democracy really being the engine for this, because when you asked about the mechanism, what gets more votes? Right? Do you propose? People are upset. People are frustrated. Upward mobility is slowing. They want the American dream. Do you propose, you know, what progressives propose? Well, we have so much structural racism and oppression. We need massive institutional reform. We need major redistribution, which is going to take a long time. Or, you know what? It's the Mexicans and the Chinese and the, you know, the Muslims. And it's a very effective way of generating votes. And Milosevic saw this, Serbia for the Serbs. I mean, it's everywhere. In Zimbabwe, you know, Zimbabwe for the black Zimbabweans, whites out of Zimbabwe. It's extremely effective.
So that's a brilliant account and explanation for the rise of Donald Trump and his presidency. How does the coastal heartland distinction map on to what I think of as a different kind of identity politics of race and gender and pushing that identity politics on the culture, in the universities and the like? How does that relate to the coastal heartland, and how does it relate to our politics?
Well, first of all, the coastal elite concept is very misleading. I'm using it loosely to kind of get the concept out. I mean, from the point of view of a lot of people in the middle of the country, college activists, Black Lives Matter activists who view themselves as oppressed minorities are part of these coastal elites. It was a really brilliant Nigerian-American student who gave me this insight. I couldn't believe, I perceived as a coastal elite. And Republicans and Republican establishment and Democratic establishment all lumped into this. But to answer your question, oversimplifying a little bit, but I think this is accurate, coastal elites tend to be much more receptive to what you're calling identity politics. This is something that actually happened on the left. As some of you may remember, even just, you know, 50 years ago, the civil rights, the watchword of the left 50 years ago were, they appealed to group transcending ideals. The watchwords were inclusivity or equality. And we were looking, the idea was to a day where skin color wouldn't matter. That was Martin Luther King. Universal human rights, right? Super progressive position. Not even just skin color. Even a time when national boundaries wouldn't matter, right? We're all going to be just individuals. That was a very progressive left-wing position. Starting probably in the late 80s and 90s, a lot of progressives, understandably, this is justifiable, started to see that the right's supposedly colorblind rhetoric, oh, we're group blind, we're universalist, was being used to oppose affirmative action and oppose a lot of policies that the left wanted to see that they thought they needed to redress racial and historical inequities. So they were like, you know, we're sick of this group neutral language. And today on college campuses, as Jack well knows, group blindness is the ultimate sin. If you try to propose group blindness, you will instantly be branded as contributing to structural race. I mean, really, you know, that's not an exaggeration. And the groups have also multiplied because, and I'm, you know, people don't quite understand me. I'm very sympathetic to this. I think, I feel like everything is black and white. Get rid of identity politics. It's all their fault. And I am, as a minority woman, I am a very tribal person. I derive a lot of my own strength and identity from who I am. I've been frustrated all my life, you know, people speaking for me, telling me what's good for me. So I get it. And even a term like intersectionality, what happens is these terms get weaponized.
You need to explain that
okay.
term.
Okay, so these terms get...
This is very much an academic term.
It's very academic, and it gets weaponized. The right now just makes fun of it. But as with so many of these things, the original driving force was a good one. And intersectionality is the idea that we have more than one group, so that a Latino woman's experience is very different from an Asian woman's experience, is very different from, and then there are more, so a gay Asian woman's experience is very different from a straight Asian, and this can multiply. There are, you know,
endlessly.
But I am not just one to make fun of it. This is the thing. I think it's easy to just, this is part of the problem. So I have a gay Asian student who adopted from North Carolina who said, you know, it is so important for me to actually be with other people who understand me. So I get where it's coming from. My critique, yes, I'm pretty hard on both sides. It's to the point where sometimes it seems frivolous, some of the things. I have a very progressive student who is so to the left of everybody here. His parents are undocumented, Mexican-American. And he was one of my research assistants, incredibly important, really criticizing himself and his own. He said, I think the left made so many mistakes. We focused on some things that were not important. He's like, okay, so the nachos are inauthentic, you know, or the sombrero. If everything is racist and sexist, then nothing is. And what he said, and, you know, people here have different political views, but what he said is, I think that the left cried wolf too many times, so that when the real wolf came along, no one even noticed. Everybody was numbed. So that's, you know, I have a kind of nuanced view on identity politics.
No, I agree. I completely agree. You describe it well, you defend it well, and you critique it well. It's actually a very fair-minded account in that regard. So the book tells it what I viewed as a very discouraging story about what seemed like the possibility of assimilation when may have been only made possible because there was a white dominant majority. And as that white dominant majority loses power, it's becoming angrier and more insecure and trying to grab its benefits for its group. All these other groups are seeing themselves as groups trying to grab the goodies for themselves. And it is really your explanation for how discordant our society is. I read the book as being mostly pretty discouraging. I was even more depressed about our politics after I read your book than before. But you have this chapter at the end where you're optimistic, and you've said in some of your interviews that you remain optimistic. So I'm not optimistic. Tell me why we should be optimistic, and I'm going to tell you why I disagree.
Okay, so here are some interesting statistics. Many of the people, most of the people who are most against immigration and afraid of immigration in this country are actually people who maybe have never met an immigrant or actually interacted with them. So the fear is going from 0 to 1, not 20% to 30%. It's kind of interesting. So my favorite studies in that last epilogue are also about how we as humans differ from other primates. We can overcome tribalism. The Enlightenment Project was an attempt to, and America was supposed to be, right? These principles of democracy and rule of individualism. But the studies that I find very heartening are that show very, very vigorously that if you can pull people out of their tribes and have them interact as human beings, it's unbelievable what progress can be made. Big caveat, I am not just saying toss them together, more exposure. There are tons of studies that show that more diversity actually makes people hate each other more, right? I mean, just putting a lot of different people together, that's not what I'm talking about. The studies are very specific that if you can pull them out of their tribal context and have them interact. So you take somebody who voted for President Trump and somebody violently against and say, you cannot talk about politics, but talk about your hopes for your children, pets, movies, pizza, sports, and people will find common ground. And I'll just give two quick examples. The integration of the military in the 50s, super uplifting example. It was as bad as it was today. 99% public opinion against this. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but and in the military too against it. But after they did it, more studies, more surveys, and what they found was first that the integrated units were as effective or superior to the all-white units. And then when they interviewed the people, it was amazing. People were like, you know, when you're forced to sleep in the same quarters and miss your parents together and eat the same food, it wasn't just about black and white. Irish Americans had never met Swedish Americans, and they had accents at the time, and Italian Americans and Mexican Americans. What they said is when you have to trust your life to somebody else, you don't care what accent they have or what color of skin. And it's an incredibly uplifting. In fact, the military continues to be, I think, a very good example. And the other one is same-sex marriage. Just 30 years ago, 90% of Americans were against same-sex marriage. Now it's about 60% in favor. That's very dramatic change in 30 years. How? Again, really clear evidence. It's because this faceless group, these people, suddenly became people you knew. Suddenly you realize, oh my gosh, this includes my cousin, my son, my neighbor, my colleague, my friend. And once you could see these people as human beings, the norm changed very quickly, actually, very quickly. So I'm very depressed, about the market dominant minority thing, because I did say in the New York Times that I have found zero cases, mostly from the developing world, of countries with a market dominant minority having overcome these dynamics. But here's the thing, I don't think we necessarily have one. I think, you know, ours is such a weird, everything's a construct. I mean, even ethnicity is. But this particular form of a market dominant minority is really a construct.
But it is the case that there aren't any hopeful examples out there about a majority dominant becoming, losing the majority, groups rising up. There aren't any examples in history, are there? Or no obvious examples where that process went well?
Not when you have a very small, resented minority that is viewed as just so not caring about
the real
Americans.
So you think that the fact that the whites are still predominant, and maybe because we have this at least partial history of assimilation and group identity?
It's true that when I come to D.C., I get more pessimistic.
New Haven makes you less pessimistic?
Okay, those are the two cities.
Okay.
I mean, I just came from Seattle. First of all, maybe we could talk about social media, but the loudest voices are definitely the most depressing, and also, this is a political city, so that's scary because what's going to win votes, and that is discouraging. But my own view, and I think somebody should do a survey of that. I think ordinary Americans all across all races are getting tired of it. It's very corrosive, you know, to be so mad all the time. And I think I just learned about this Better Angels group, and I get emails from high school students, Generation Z, we're taking bipartisan, whatever. To answer your question, I think, no, I don't think it's white staying dominant as the right answer. I think that if we can take measures so that the coastal elites and the heartland are not viewed as enemies, like different groups, you know, there should be fluidity. For example, David Schleicher's work, just more, if we could fix...
It's your colleague David Schleicher at Yale.
My colleague David Schleicher at Yale, work on geographical mobility. It used to be so much more. You could be in the middle of the country, not wealthy, go to public school, move out. Now, with the cost of education, how expensive, it's impossible to live in D.C. or New York.
Let me quickly make the pessimistic case, and then I'll ask you one final question. So, I agree with what you said in the book and what you say here. I, too, see, especially after the election of Donald Trump, signs all over the place, I would say small signs, of a lot of institutions trying to make efforts to recognize this problem and deal with it and overcome it. The reason I'm pessimistic, in addition to all the reasons you give in your book, is one, because what you just mentioned, the internet and social media, which, because of its structure, because of the splintering and decentralization of the media, because private speech is so easy to utter, and because extreme speech tends to get attention. That's one thing that's exacerbating the problem. And on the other side, I'm just not sure what the unifying ideal is. I mean, you talked about patriotism earlier. Your book makes pretty clear that a good chunk of the country, mostly on the coasts, don't much care for patriotism. They're more cosmopolitan than patriotic. Maybe the answer is to try to replicate the example of World War II, which is a clear success case with the integration of the military. Maybe national service would be an answer, but that's a heavy, heavy, heavy lift. So my next last question is, given the internet and given it's not clear what the ideal is, how do you see us becoming a supergroup again?
I agree with you. I think a lot of the work is in how do we get that connective tissue? How can we have an overarching national identity that is going to be enough to bind us and resonate for so many people, many of whom are now saying, that I don't like that founding story. They were the people that enslaved us. I agree. So, again, I'm not even trying to just be... I think on conservatives need to realize, conservatives think that they are the ones that are the champion of the patriotism and the strong national identity. I critique that. I think it's important to realize that having a strong identity that can bind Americans together isn't just a matter of flag waving and singing the anthem very loudly. If you want a lot of people to buy into this concept of this country as a moral and just country, it has to be perceived as legitimate. You know, if you're from a group that just think your perception is that your group is just shot indiscriminately all the time, why would you buy into the idea of this country as a great country? So work needs to be done on not, I think sometimes conservatives get so frustrated with all the complaining and whining that it's like, we're there, we fixed it, and we haven't fixed it. You know, a lot of this, what feels so terrible right now, is actually just formerly suppressed voices finally allowed to express themselves. On the left, I am very harsh. I describe it as the scorched earth approach to history. You know, I say there's a world of difference between saying we have these great ideals, this Constitution, but we have repeatedly and shamefully failed to live up to them. You know, terrible. We really have it. There's a huge difference between saying that we have failed to live up to these ideals and that we've got to do better, and saying that those ideals are just hypocrisy and lies. And you see this. You see Michael Moore saying that this is America's a land of oppression, a land of cowards. This country was built on genocide. So it's a huge difference. It may sound just like words, but it's true that we extinguished populations. We did do those things. But to say that the principles on which we are built is white supremacy and genocide, I disagree with. And one line I have in my book is, if America really is nothing but a land of genocide built on white supremacy, then why is it even worth fighting for? And I sometimes hear that. I can get depressed too. I'll hear people saying exactly, you know. But I think it is worth it. And on your social media thing, I have this weird maybe immigrant daughter's optimism. Like, I think that this country has the fastest self-correction mechanism. I view 2016 election, whatever people's politics, as like shaking things up, you know. And right now, social media, think how fast we went from idolizing Mark Zuckerberg and all those guys. They were just gods like 3 years ago to like most hated group in the country. And so I think somebody could invent something. There's so much productivity and originality here. Maybe somebody's going to come up with a social media thing that cuts through this. I don't know.
That sounds optimistic. let me. So your books all have a quality, but more so in this one, and that is your extraordinary ability to step outside of what's going on. I mean, this book is really amazing because it does an excellent job of describing these group dynamics that we all participate in, but you're really able to step outside and see both sides' perspectives, both in the positive light and the negative light. So my question is, how do you do that? Why do you do that? What is it about you that makes you able to do that?
You know, I think I've always been an outsider. I really feel this way, and I've actually thought about this. That's almost a privilege and an honor for me. I feel like um, I I've always wanted to turn this feeling of being an outsider into a source of strength. And that's actually a thing that runs through all my books. So I grew up one of the only Chinese kid in West Lafayette, Indiana for 8 years. Actually, people were very nice to my family. But I was always, we were the weird ones that brought Chinese food in thermoses. I had a Chinese accent. We couldn't do anything that other people could do. Then I went to California, also felt completely like an outsider. Just, you know, I'm very, I love Harvard where I went to school, but I was like the public school kid with big hair. I didn't even know about boarding schools. I'd never heard of the concept. You know, I didn't know that people would go. Yeah, but I mean, like, that people would go sleep somewhere else if they go to school. And, you know, I feel very much an outsider, but in a good way, not like I'm so. So I think I've always just never quite really belonged anywhere. When I go to China, I'm a total outsider. I think when I'm here, I'm, a, you know. So, you know, even like Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, you know, it's viewed as, oh my God, she's defending this strict parenting, authoritarian. My mother, she said, no Chinese person would ever have written this book. It's so rebellious and contrary. You're taking on this whole view of how to do it. So I think it's the reason is not that I'm trying anything. I just actually don't fit in anywhere. You know?
It's great. It's really terrific. The book's terrific there. Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please share the Lawfare Podcast on Facebook, tweet about it, start subreddits about it, and please give us a rating and review wherever you listen to us. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.